it truly was like, oh my goodness, I cannot teach what I need to teach until you understand that this is a team and a culture. I need you to understand that. So everything, I used every bit of my drum major powers to excite them and make it an environment where they could feel like they could just be very weird. And that nobody, if we're all weird together, no one's gonna judge you. Everyone's gonna wanna be you.
Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of the Bandwagon Podcast for the week of March 4th, 2024. On this edition of the program, news and notes from the band world, including a Kansas City high school student is accepted into the Missouri All-State Band, and why this is a bigger deal than usual. The Pride of Arizona gains another feather in its cap. I got your band-related internet rabbit hole of the week right here. And the very first bandwagon interview. It's going to knock your socks off. I'm your host, Rob Hammerton. Hello to you, the listener of this podcast. If you're finding us for the first time, you're getting in pretty close to the ground floor. I don't even think you need to listen to this podcast's episodes in order. So if you like this one, feel free to go back and take a listen to our opening episode. After a few episodes, our format will probably settle in, and hopefully it'll become familiar. But the basic idea is, it's organized like a march. The first strain will usually be a news roundup from the band world. The second strain will probably be about as close to opinionated commentary as I'll get. I'll leave the opinions to you and our interview guests. Speaking of guests, that's the trio. A conversation with a person who is in or adjacent to the band activity. The dogfight is kind of a wild card. Could be a band-related internet rabbit hole, or it could be a couple of band jokes, or who knows what else. I'll wrap things up with a little coda, and then, if I'm doing a decent job, there will be applause. Again, the logical format for a podcast about bands would be a march. So, sitting up straight, feet flat on the floor, let's play the first strain. In this episode's first strain, news and notes from the band world. And until we get going on a weekly basis, which is very soon, the news and notes may be drawn from a little further back in band history than just this week. And actually, it's been a heck of a last 3 or 4 months. Here's the kind of thing that will probably populate the first strain as we go forward. Dateline, Kansas City, Missouri. 17-year-old Ralph Jarl performed as second chair bass clarinetist in the Missouri All-State Band back in January. Why does this matter, apart from being a notable musical achievement? Because Jarl's achievement comes just months after he was shot twice on a stranger's property. Jarl was shot in the head and in the right arm on the evening of April 13, 2023 by Andrew Lester, a Kansas City homeowner, after the teenager mistakenly arrived at the wrong address, Lester's, looking to pick up his twin siblings. Lester faced charges of one count of felony assault in the first degree and one count of armed criminal action, which is also a felony offense. He pleaded not guilty. If you heard this news story last year, you may recall the homeowner had told police that he, quote, believed someone was attempting to break into the house, unquote, and grabbed a gun before going to the door because he was scared. Meanwhile, the All-State Band selection was Ralph Jarl's first after having earned an honorable mention in a previous year. Dateline, Tucson, Arizona. The John Philip Sousa Foundation has awarded its 2024 through 2026 Sudler Trophy to the University of Arizona Marching Band. The trophy rewards a college or university marching band that has demonstrated the highest musical standards and innovative marching routines and ideas. Although the trophy has been nicknamed the Heisman Trophy of the college band world, the Sousa Foundation takes great pains to note that the Sudler Trophy is not a contest to select the best college band in any given year, but rather is a reward for making important contributions to the advancement of the performance standards of college marching bands over a period of years. The Arizona Band was founded in 1902 as a dozen-member military unit. In 1907, the university established a non-military band. The original ROTC band dissolved in 1920 when the U Arizona Band began offering one-unit credit. In 1967, the band played at halftime of the first ever Super Bowl. In 1977, it marched in President Jimmy Carter's inaugural parade. The band was named one of the top 5 college marching bands in the country in 2009 by the College Band Directors National Association. Past Sudler recipients include university bands from Michigan, Illinois, Ohio State, Florida A&M, the University of Texas at Austin, Oklahoma, Michigan State, Kansas, Iowa, Arizona State, Northwestern, UCLA, James Madison University, Purdue, Nebraska, West Virginia University, UMass, Texas Tech, Georgia, Texas A&M, Louisiana State, Alabama, Auburn, Penn State, Arkansas, Indiana, Western Carolina University, Notre Dame, Florida, Kansas State, Iowa State, Westchester University, and Jacksonville State. And that's news and notes from the band world for this week. If you have a news item you think should be included in this segment, send me a link via email to heybandwagon@yahoo.com. Now we'll take a quick water break and meet you on the other side. Do keep listening, I implore you. Okay, let's pick it up at the second strain. In this week's second strain, a bit of storytelling from me. As this podcast progresses, I anticipate this second segment being dedicated to commentary, most times in the service of advocacy, advocating for the band activity in the face of budget cuts or of unqualified sports columnists opining about the worthiness of the band activity, that sort of thing. But every so often, in the spirit of telling war stories from our band experiences, which, by the way, I encourage you to do by either sending me an email or recording a voicemail on that nifty SpeakPipe message page I've got, and you can find both those links in the show notes, I shall tell a war story from my band experience. Hey, if Keith Olbermann can read James Thurber stories on his podcast, then I can read from my own blog. At least I own the copyright on it, so I can check with myself and say, yes, you have permission to read that blog post from 2012, lightly edited for clarity and context. So here, from April 11th, 2012, is a post from my now pretty dormant online blog about a former professor who was not a musician and a lesson he taught me long after I graduated college. The post was published the day after he passed away. Don't judge a book by its cover. This is what I was taught when I was very small. Just because someone's appearance matches a widely accepted image of how this or that person or people usually are, doesn't necessarily mean that's how someone really is. Every once in a while, though, image and reality are one and the same. Before I succumbed to the truth that I really wanted to have music as my vocation, I had clung to the philosophy that you can't make a living at it. So as I tried to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up, I considered that writing had always been one of my other favorite activities, and that my experiences with school newspapers and the like suggested that journalism might be the path to follow. Following the time-honored tradition of 17-year-olds being asked to decide what their life's work would be, I looked for a college that had a well-regarded journalism major program. Considering what I knew and didn't know at age 17 and what I didn't know that I didn't know, I now think that time-honored tradition is entirely unrealistic. On the other hand, there are people who fret that if their kid doesn't get into the right preschool, Harvard and Yale won't be an option later. I found such a school right in my backyard, more or less, the University of Massachusetts. At the time, research couldn't be done online, since there really was no online, so utilizing the information gleaned from the card catalogs and reference books of various local public libraries and guidance department bookshelves, I got the sense that UMass Amherst had journalistic things happening. Plus, a heck of a band. We're immediately into the double bonus here. Fast forward to a couple of semesters into my college life. One particular journalism class that I needed to take was taught by just one professor, and my thought was, ah, at last. The professor's name was Howard Ziff. I'd occasionally glimpsed him on my way through the halls of journalism. Well, okay, the one hallway in UMass's Bartlett Hall wherein the Journalistic Studies Program offices were located. A burly bear of a man with a voice that rumbled at a comfortable 2.1 on the Richter scale. I hadn't had a single conversation with him yet, but somehow I knew that he fit my stereotypical image of a genuine journalist perfectly. As the Pulitzer Prize-winning UMass journalism professor Madeline Blaze once said, Ziff was more of a city editor than even a real city editor. Young men and women came to feel like they had met the real thing. He had a gruff exterior, was good with one-liners, smoked a pipe, and claimed to have a bottle of scotch in his desk. And so, I attended his class at the wintry beginning of an Amherst spring semester. First impressions don't often lie. I left the first meeting of the class wishing that the second one would start right away. As the semester went on, I did the readings, wrote the papers, completed the course requirements. But, to paraphrase an old saying, I came for the class, but I stayed for the tales. The man was the city editor of the Chicago Daily News in the 1960s, for heaven's sake. He had an air of authenticity that simply cannot be bought at the local 7-Eleven. Howard M. Ziff passed away yesterday, is what I wrote in April 2012. Already, myriad Ziff stories have begun to surface publicly, brought forward by legions of former students and other admirers, and most of them in some way point to that quality of being the real deal, the, forgive the pun, genuine article. The stories were always there, of course, but as always seems to be the case, it's after someone passes away that people are moved to wax eloquent. It's not wrong, though it is sad that so often that's what it takes for us to tell people what we think of them. Once I heard someone suggest that they wouldn't mind hearing how they'd be eulogized, and I heard someone else suggest that we should have memorial services for people while they're still with us. Oh, I do get a slightly odd sense about that idea. One Ziff story goes this way. Word came into the Chicago Daily News City Desk in April of 1968 that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated. Ziff turned to a reporter and said, "Find Rosa Parks." Holy cow. In the Daily Hampshire Gazette's article about Ziff's passing, there was a proliferation of nouns such as editor, teacher, mentor, raconteur, I love that one, friend. And the adjectives included dedicated, ebullient, streetwise, legendary, gruff, intense, wise. All accurate. Most important and most desperately needed nowadays was his philosophy of the teaching of journalism, that, as UMass journalism professor B.J. Roach put it, it should be not just a vocational field, but a humanities-based thing, where professors were not just teaching people how to type, but to understand the role of journalism in the world. Ziff thought there were certain obligations that went beyond interviewing celebrities. Anyway, back to the mid-late 1980s. This journalism major, whose life was at least as much wrapped up in music made while on one's feet and wearing a bright red uniform and a hat with feathers sticking up out of it, received the benefit of Howard Ziff's wisdom for several semesters. He took me seriously as a journalism student, seriously enough that I made sure to take his subject seriously right back. You cannot fool the real deal. You cannot fudge an assignment, not if you're going to pass it into a professor who, as UMass Alumni Association fixture John Haidt put it, could very easily be the most interesting man in the world. And yet, I went on to make a living as a music teacher. Ordinarily, I'd be unsure as to how to square that reality with the fact that one of my professors was as committed to journalism as anyone could be, and that I had reacted so strongly and positively to that commitment. I'd been considering moving on from the editorial world as I was starting to doubt my ability to make an actual living within it.
How do those words taste now, Rob?
Weirdly, when that editorial world laid me off, even though it cleared the way for me to pursue a next career, I felt just a wee bit, well, if not guilty, then at least odd. That not quite 7 years after having invested all that time and money in a journalism degree, I was pulling the ripcord. There was one conversation, though, that occurred somewhat before that layoff, which eased my mind a bit. I was spending a fall weekend back on the UMass campus, staying overnight with local friends and visiting the Friday afternoon and Saturday morning rehearsals of the Minuteman Marching Band, followed, of course, by the Saturday football game and all the halftime and post-game pageantry that went with it. I wore my band jacket all weekend, badly faded, but still evidence of all the school spirit that came with 4 years in the band. After the Friday afternoon rehearsal, I walked away from Old Chapel, then the home of the band, and passed the nearby Bartlett Hall on my way to my car, and crossed paths with Professor Ziff. A great big rumble of a greeting.
Rob Hamerton, how are you?
There was no question mark at the end of that sentence, so I have dutifully not included it here either. I was beyond pleased. Years later, I was still somewhere in his database. I obviously would have hoped so, but at the same time, I wasn't quite sure. He was a busy man, and how many hundreds, thousands of names and faces has he had to keep straight over the years? We exchanged questions and answers that were just this side of small talk.
What are you doing now? How's it going?
Still no question marks. Well, there's not much actual journalism in my current editorial job. In fact, the writing that I do, according to the style sheet of the magazine, doesn't even get me a byline. Tough to develop a portfolio that way. It's a trade magazine, after all, not the Boston Globe. To my employer, Chicago isn't an editorial style. It's a trade show locale.
Ziff grunted sympathetically.
Then he asked a question that he seemed to know the answer to already.
What brings you back here tonight?
There was a definite question mark there. Well, tomorrow's high school band day, and I came out from Eastern Mass to lend a hand wherever they might need it. It's going to be the usual 3,000-person-strong day of organized chaos, so...
Ah, yes, said Ziff. Makes sense.
Without a trace of guilt-laying or sarcasm or disappointment.
It's great that you still come up and stay connected with this.
Well, I've got friends and a sister who are marching right now, so I get to hang out with them as well.
Which is important.
And then Ziff said it.
Anyway, yeah, you were a good journalism guy, but let's face it, you were really majoring in band.
In the hands of a different person, that remark might have reduced me to a smoldering pile of journalistic ashes. But Ziff said it with a conspiratorial twinkle in his eye and a smile in his voice. He might actually have been smiling, but his beard and pipe made it tough to spot sometimes. So instead, I was able to smile a bit, to abashedly agree with him, to be not at all surprised that he'd seen right through me, and to walk away not just alive, but reassured that it was probably okay if I pursued a career other than journalism. I'd been reassured by one of the titans of the industry that I should do something I love, even if it was in someone else's industry. Perhaps if it had been any other, lesser journalism professor, I'd have spent the rest of the weekend with the weight of that world on my shoulders. But Howard Ziff made it clear, you need to do what you love. That's not all I'll miss him for, but it counts for a lot, I think. All right, let's grab another short break and get hydrated. On the other side of the break, I've got a conversation for you that I think you'll enjoy. So stick around. And no, that was not a percussion joke. And yes, it's going to be like this. Okay, let's change keys and get into the trio section. This week in the trio section, it's my pleasure to be joined by somebody whom I've had the opportunity to work with a little bit at the Old Drum Major Academy in the last couple of summers. She's a music teacher, she's a researcher, she's a salsa band baritone saxophonist, and I'm going to admit I haven't known a whole lot of those in my life. If you've been in Western Massachusetts in the last several years, you also may have seen her possibly on the podium in front of some outfit called the Minuteman Marching Band, or behind the wheel of a Pioneer Valley Transit Authority bus. Renaissance person, or just casting your net really wide? Let's find out. Please help me welcome to the program, Zoe Stinson. Hi, Zoe.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me today.
So we were chatting a little bit before we got going here with the actual recording, and you talked a little bit about a strategy you've used in your first year plus of music teaching, which made me want to know more because it seemed to be an idea that might strike terror into the hearts of traditional music curriculum writers. So I'm curious about that. But first, let me start here with a few lightning round questions so people can get an idea of whom they're listening to. So I think I may have given this away. What's your primary instrument?
I'm a saxophonist through and through, but I play lots of cello on the side, and I dabble in clarinet and flute as well.
What's your current band-related role?
I'm currently a band director at East Windsor Middle School. I also perform in many local groups, as you mentioned earlier. I'm an avid salsa player. Suddenly, after college, I got reeled into that culture and that activity, so I've been really enjoying it since then. But you can find me anywhere that has a saxophone part.
What bands have you been active with in your life, whether playing or doing things with?
I've been all over the place. Actually, you mentioned my marching band experience. My only marching experience is with the Minuteman Marching Band. Before that, I came from New York, so marching band was not necessarily a priority. It was mostly competitive honor bands. And so that's a lot of where my background comes in. As I mentioned, I started on saxophone in fourth grade, and I was involved in the Empire State Youth Orchestra. I was also a member of multiple community orchestras on the cello. I took private lessons throughout my schooling. And yeah, that's mostly where my band background comes from.
How did you get into playing the saxophone?
I love answering this question. So we got to pick our instruments in third grade. So that's when we would have our meet the instrument night. You would go, it was a whole event. So you go to the school in the evening, and someone would let you try each of the instruments, and you would go to different rooms with a piece of paper checking off. It's like a roadmap. And I was sold on playing the trombone. That was what I was going to do. That was going to be me, my whole personality. I walked into the trombone room first, and I go to make a sound, and I took a deep breath, and nothing came out. Obviously, nowadays, I look back and I'm like, oh, well, I wasn't buzzing. No one told me I had to buzz my lips together. You know, as a third grader, I was like, oh, this stinks. I'm moving on. So I went to every single room, and I couldn't make a good sound out of any instrument except for, fill in the blank, the saxophone. We could also pick orchestra instruments at that point, and I also really enjoyed the sound of the cello. But my parents would only let me pick one instrument that year because I had never really stuck to anything, like any activity up until that time. So I chose saxophone. I played it for a year, and I came home after my first day of learning it in school, and I said to my mom, "Mom, I suck at the saxophone." That was my exact wording. And so she was like, "Well, let's get her in private lessons." And so that's where it all started. And from there, I just became obsessed with learning things by ear. Was my favorite thing to do. I did not like to read, but I liked to play by ear. And then I picked up cello a year later.
Do you have the feeling that you got to be interested in the direction of the cello, and eventually your saxophone life took you into the tenor and baritone world until you got to the baritone and did the old stick and stay thing? I wonder if you were drawn to the bass clef, the sound of that?
Yes. So this is another one of my favorite stories. Flash forward 2 years. I had been playing the cello for 1 year now. And as any saxophone player would agree, the bigger the saxophone, the cooler you are. And so my band director had seen me play tenor the year before in fifth grade band. And he said to me my first day, "I want you to play the baritone saxophone." And I was like, "Me? You want me to do that?" I was like, "Of course. Let me at it. Show me where it is." It was this like ancient, barely working, clunky baritone that they had sitting in a closet. It was musty. I was thrilled. I was thrilled to play. So he threw me into a practice room with this instrument. And I think I was in there for 10 minutes and I just fell in love. And the first note that I went to go play was low D, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And I just played as loud as I could. And I could feel my glasses vibrate on my nose. And I was just obsessed. And that became my personality. I'm a Barry player. Years later in high school, it became a realization to me that the baritone saxophone and the cello are in exactly the same register. So to answer your question, yes, I think I do have an attraction to the bass clef. That is, it's half a heart as it is, the way you read it.
Being that I am largely from the 20th century, and that was a time that had, shall we say, lots of stereotypical gender norms in place in the music world. I mean, you hardly ever saw a feller playing the flute. And it wasn't until I went to college that I got to see women playing the trombone and tuba. It was the bass clef question was kind of a shot in the dark, but I had a suspicion, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And in response to, you know, their comment on gender norms, that was also something that really formed my passion for the baritone, because I kept getting those comments like, "You can barely carry that thing," that case, which I would bring home every day to and from school with pride, really. And then the comments like, "The thing is as big as you are. I can't believe you make that big of a sound." So then it was like, okay, fine, I can make it louder. And it was always a competition for me. You know, so nowadays, you know, I play in these salsa groups where they want you to be the loudest instrument in the band as a baritone player. So I'm pushing every ounce of air that I have, breathing almost after every two notes or so. I think there's the stereotype that women, and especially women of my size, I'm pretty slender. So a lot of times you think, oh, you're not going to get much air out of that, you know, but I have to overcome that. And it's just been my experience.
Hint to those people, I practice this.
Yeah, women practice too.
Now that you have mentioned your current teaching hitch a little bit, let's dive into that a bit. What's your East Windsor origin story?
So I applied to all the schools that were looking for music teachers. I was open to anything, really. But I was really always so inspired by, I wanted to teach middle school band. During student teaching, I really enjoyed that level. I found that middle school students are some of the most creative people in the world, if you lead them to be. They are just an explosion of color and unique thought. So I was looking for middle school, and the first job that I got offered, selfishly, I'll say that East Windsor Well, they called me and they were like, you know what? Blue Cross Blue Shield, that's your health insurance. I was like, a union health insurance? This is the one for me. Middle school band. But the kicker was band and chorus and everything. I would be the only teacher at my school. And I learned very quickly after I accepted the position that this was going to be an uphill battle to build, because it was not just I'm walking in the door and there's going to be kids playing instruments. It was, I need to build that. I need to teach kids what exactly they signed up for because they didn't know. The issue became that kids were signed up for band and thrown into the class that didn't even have an instrument or know what instruments they could play. The questions were, can I play the piano? Can I play guitar? And any band person knows that you can't just play ukulele in a band. You play wind instruments and percussion. That's what you have in band. But they don't know that. And so I had to teach them that and get them instruments, inventory, everything. The band class was supposed to be held on the stage where all the equipment was. I walked in for the first time and it was a storage closet during COVID. I realized very quickly that the kids were not interested in, they were not buying what I was trying to sell them. They were not interested in playing instruments per se. They were not inspired by the idea of learning how to make a sound out of something. It was just, I'm in this class. I realized that I had to establish an expectation that, you know, this is a culture. And you and I both know, being coming from the UMass marching band, culture is everything. Culture and tradition. That's what drives band. And so the only way that I truly knew how to share that with them was by bringing them to multi-bands. I had to bring them to the place I knew could teach them the best. And so my first year, I was there for maybe a week or two, and I emailed my admin. I was like, I need to plan a field trip, like stat. I need to order tickets. We need to do this. This is emergent. So anyways, we bring them to multi-bands, and you know, everything just kind of, it just kind of rolled from there. The bus ride home, I just kept hearing from the back, yo, I can't wait to go to UMass. I can't wait to go to college. I want to play my instrument like that. Oh my God, did you see the saxophones? Did you see the trombone ensemble? What was that weird looking 7 trombone? That was so cool. That was so low. Those were the things that they were saying. Things that they never would have thought about 2 months prior. And I was so inspired by listening to them chat behind me on the bus ride home. They were just electric. I just recently came back from a trip to TMEA, the Texas Music Educators Association. They had a conference. It's meant for Texas people, but people come from all over, and I'm people. So I was at a Dr. Tim session, and one of the things that he says, it's people are motivated after the event. It's true that after that, suddenly the kids were coming into class, putting their instruments together without me having to nag them 1,000 times. And they were like, what are we learning today? So that, I kind of went really far with your initial question of
no.
The East Windsor story. But yeah, that's where it all started.
In one sense, well, obviously, but in another sense, how much of a revelation this is, I'm not even sure. But it's not easy to get kids to that point on page 4 of the Red Book. And Dr. Tim, speaking of whom, is one of the authors of the purple version of the Red Book. So it's not as if he hasn't been involved with that end of it. But I've been in situations, and I'm sure you have as well, where it's a question of what drives things, the heart or the head. And so there's your living, breathing example of that.
That leads me to my philosophy in teaching music. I think any team activity, whether you're talking athletics or music or theater, whatever it may be, it is culture before technique. Culture before content is what is going to drive your ensembles to be the best ensembles that they can ever be.
Which is a concept that, as I said, it might strike terror into the hearts of people writing curricula, or even people who are starting kids on instruments because of the must get them 3 notes that they can play so that we can play Hot Cross Buns
And so in my case, so we can have them say, oh, these fingerings aren't that much different from recorders, and I did those already. Oh, that can be the version, the very extremely small version of the, oh, I've made a connection to something else. But it's a head connection still. The experience of getting one's charges into a situation where they see, oh, this is what it can be, it's a big deal. I circle back to this, and as you were telling the story, I was thinking, holy heck and dang. So you were dealing with, what age folks were you dealing with in that sort of, I'm in band and I don't know an instrument situation?
Quite literally all of them, fifth grade through eighth grade. But yeah, it truly was like, oh my goodness, I cannot teach what I need to teach until you understand that this is a team and a culture. I need you to understand that. So everything, I used every bit of my drum major powers to excite them and make it an environment where they could feel like they could just be very weird, and that nobody, if we're all weird together, no one's going to judge you. Everyone's going to want to be you with that confidence. So I started off with start thought, you got to give 200% because you can't, because everyone else is going to give about half of that. So I gave 200% and I created an environment of echoing. It is fairly common for me to gesture to myself. I say, you say, pass it off, do exactly as I do. And it became, especially with the younger grades, it would be do as I do. And I would say it in really ridiculous ways and act in ridiculous ways.
Yes.
And they truly would do as I did. And now they just do it. They just act that way. They say weird things and act in weird ways because they're middle schoolers and they know, okay, my teacher does this.
And it's okay and it's safe to do that.
And it's safe to do this here. Yes.
Yeah.
So then now you're like, okay, well, how are we assessing? How are we assessing learning in this chaotic mess that you have here? Well, it was like hiding vegetables in a smoothie. Literacy was a huge thing we struggled with last year. And something that I actually introduced to them right away was solfège. So this is the choir teacher in me. Now, this was also happening on the choir side, but I was really focusing on band. I think my goals here were to teach a couple of things. It was to avoid the confusion of concert B flat. Well, I'm not playing a B flat. You know, that was hard for them to comprehend at first. I didn't want to overwhelm them. Mm-hmm. And the second thing that I really wanted to work on with them was their aural training. So it was almost like I'm tricking you into doing really hard things. And then I would have them sight sing music as we got into notation. And they could sight sing. We're talking about fifth graders looking at the red book, you know, the standard of excellence. Mm-hmm. Okay, I want you to read number 23, sing it out loud on solfège. And some of them would be doing the hand signs with it. It was crazy. And then that led me to be able to start pep band. So my younger kids, I bring them into the basketball games, and I could teach them a song on the spot using my hands without saying a word. And I would just pulse to the rhythm that I wanted them to play it at. And suddenly we were playing Seven Nation Army. They love that. Now I'm making them learn how to read for real, but and they don't love it.
And since I stink at solfège, I'm trying to think, okay.
Mi, mi, sol, mi, re, do, ti. It's ingrained. It's in there forever.
I need to be taught that stuff continually, so thank you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's my favorite thing to talk about.
So now you have people who have begun their instruments relative split seconds ago who are in a gym full of basketball fans, and the basketball fans are digging it.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have an actual live fire experience for them to lock in what they felt on a bus.
Yes. So suddenly it was a pride thing. There was a pride factor.
Okay, so the origin story is year one. Now you come back for year two. What kind of understandings were in place that could allow you to go forward? And how's the going forward process gone?
That's a great question. It was what I was wondering all summer. And I found upon my return it was like a flood of kids coming to the band room to drop off their instruments. Just, miss, my instrument's not working. I tried to practice over the, all these, just a wave of information thrown at me. But compared to last year, or the my first year, it was like, oh, who's this girl? You know, like, so, and actually, I think I was greeted by a sixth grader who was in my fifth grade band. Miss Stinson, you are the god of the school. I was like, oh, okay. So I take it you're glad that I came back. Because the expectation at the time was, okay, we get a new music teacher every year. So that's what we're coming from, unfortunately. And that is the unfortunate reality for many schools. But to move forward with your question on, okay, so how was I able to take what the foundations I gave them that year, and how were we able to move on? So you think about, you know, all of my grades were beginner, except for I think eighth grade. Most of them had a pretty solid foundation because they had a really steady teacher. But everybody else was brand spanking new. So they all came back, and year two has become this emphasis on literacy. Can you take information off of a page? And can you put it into your instrument? And that has been across the board. And so I've been using a lot of strategies to get them more familiar with music notation. I think the biggest challenge has been pulling them away from the solfège, actually. They are resistant to that. They do not like using letter names.
In your other classes, we cannot necessarily read you the textbook. You have to go and read it.
Yeah, and you need to learn how to use the tools that you've been given. So it was, again, like, you know, with middle schoolers, you need to say it about 60,000 times.
I hear you.
But so the literacy has been going really well. They have been growing a ton. Now we're digging into the technique of it all, as you know. So last year was culture. This is now we're into technique.
So your sixth, seventh, and eighth grade band folks have had the year of let's build this culture. And now let's step into the technique world. Is your strategy with your new fifth graders to focus on that culture before technique thing as well, and to make that kind of a every beginner year, this is where we start and kick them forward? It sounds like a dumb question as I say it, but it's worth wondering.
I don't think it's a dumb question at all. I will say the culture part is definitely a reduction than the intensive course that was last year in band culture for everybody, because it wasn't established before. There was no one to look up to see, well, this is the way you do it. But now it's just the sixth, seventh, and eighth grade students are actively setting the example. So it's not as necessary that I am showing them how the culture operates. At this point, this is only my second year of teaching, but it is my intent that every beginner class that I start, the first class begins with, you are band students. And therefore, you are the best students. That's just the way that it is. I don't make the rules. You don't make the rules. It's just what it is. So I have been able to work on technique with them much earlier on. So I would say my culture this year has morphed from super fun and goofy all the time to fun and goofy, but get it together.
Maybe you can do that a little bit because you have something to point to and say, if you're going to get there, imagine how much work it took to get there. You want to get there. You can maybe imagine that it might take more than just wishing.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So I'm going to reference my TMEA experience again. I was at this session on creating a practice culture. And now the presenter talked about how mentally draining the practice culture is, and how negative it is for everybody. From the moment you pick up your first instrument to even professionals, there is this culture that, oh, I sound terrible. I'm going to go practice. I have to practice. Oh, I need, like, or it's a punishment.
Or it's remediation, or it's...
Right. Yeah. And some kids have the natural ability to just be like, they can actually, you know, just get the motivation together and start practicing. But for the majority of students, that is not the case. I was one of those people. I am not a good practicer, mm-hmm. still to this day. I'm aware of that.
So, It's an audio podcast, so people can't see me nodding vigorously.
You can,
but
you can post that. I'm very open about it. It's something I always have struggled with. But I think it's important for me as a teacher to create a positive culture around, okay, well, if I practice, this is what the presenter said. She said, if you practice, you will gain confidence. It's like exercising. No one really likes exercise. Some people do. But it's a very small percentage of the population. Mm-hmm. You don't like exercising, but you like the way it makes you feel after. So don't you want to feel like that? Anyways, I'm really looking forward to pushing that kind of energy into my program that, hey, we're practicing because it makes us better. Makes us more confident.
And it's not because I'm failing at something.
She said, the presenter said, it's not to become a better instrumentalist per se. Even if, let's say you're in band because your parents are making you, which is the reality for some kids.
Mm-hmm.
This is not about your instrument or being able to play an instrument. It's about learning and being able to teach yourself how to be really good at something. That's a cool thing to be able to do. And when you can get really good at something, that's what gives you confidence. And I think a lot of kids that find success in band, in music, it is because it was the first thing that you learned, you were able to learn how to do and get really, really darn good at it. And I was one of those people. In fourth grade, saxophone was the first thing that I learned how to be really, really good at. And so it became my life.
So when we first had a little chat before we started recording, I will admit that when you said culture before technique, I thought this could go a couple directions. Your average person that hears somebody say culture before technique is maybe prepared to see students come out of that teaching strategy with the result being that they're very enthusiastic, but they don't read a toot. Rah, rah, and that's about it. I'm glad I've dug into this and let you describe what's gone on, because it seems to me it is a little deeper than that. And perhaps there are teachers out there whose blood pressure is maybe going down a little bit and think, okay, this is culture before technique, but not to the downplaying of technique. I can only imagine how much fun it'll be to see where this goes next year and the year after and the year after that.
Me too. I love to think about where my current kids are going to be when those four grades are plopped in the high school. Like, what kind of band is that going to sound like? What kind of instrumentation they're going to have? Culture is the soil that allows plants to grow.
Before you escape, because you're a busy person, you got stuff you got to get and do, let me hit you with some slightly less resume-oriented lightning round band questions, which I'm going to do for all these interviews. And full disclosure, this is the first one going up on the pod. And so
I better be good.
Well, so there's no tradition here. So we're building traditions as we go.
Culture before technique.
Yes. So what's one of your favorite pieces of band music that you've played, outdoors or indoors?
Can I give you a couple answers on this?
Sure.
Okay, so I'm going to give you one for saxophone quartet, because I love chamber music. That is like my favorite place to be. I would have to say for chamber, Introduction de Variations, the Pyrenees. The Pyrenees Quartet, and What Is Written on the Leaves, David Biedenbender. Awesome very part. Awesome. Just such a, it rips. I mean, the most fun I've ever had.
Is there a piece of band music that you haven't played that you would like to?
Can I give you an orchestra piece?
Sure.
Divorce. I want to play, New World Symphony. I would kill to be in the orchestra for that. That's my favorite melody of all time, the largo.
Unfortunately, you have a cello hanging around.
Yeah, I do. That is I feel like I pull it in and out of hibernation twice or so a year, and I'm like, oh yeah, you know, this is, I like this.
Is there a band that you would love to perform with that you haven't?
Sammy Rae. I will never perform with her, but Sammy Rae is a, she's a pop artist. If I could play on the stage with them, that would be my everything. She's got like a cult following, like in a positive way, not like a, I'm part of it. I'm part of the cult. Okay. So.
Aren't we all somewhere?
Yeah, we're all part. Anyone who's listening.
That's the demographic of this podcast.
If you made it this far, you're drinking the Kool-Aid. I know it.
Yeah. Tell me one of your favorite band stories.
I guess I have to pick the all-time, which was the moment I knew I wanted to be a performer. I was playing in my rock band, The Onlys, which we chatted about last time we spoke. This was my recreational band. We wrote songs together. It was a trio, so it was me, a guitarist and singer, and a drummer. And we had a gig outside. It was a festival, and it was raining that day. We were under a tent, and we started the first song, and I remember I was soloing, and I my eyes were closed for much of it, and I opened my eyes, and right in front of me, I was on the stage, but right in front of me, below me, were three little girls dancing around in tutus to the music I was creating. I was in 10th grade at the time, and that was such an impactful moment for me. And I mean, we could spend a whole other session talking about this, but my whole performing philosophy is that if the music isn't danceable, what are you doing? If people are dancing to your music, you're doing it right.
Have you got a favorite band life lesson or a bit of wisdom that you found useful outside of band?
Yeah, this one actually, I didn't learn it through band. I learned it in second grade from my teacher. Her name is Miss Sheely, and she's since retired, but we still stay in touch always. And when I was younger, I dealt with like confidence issues. I really struggled in school with socialization. And I felt really valued in her classroom. And one of the things that she would always say to me is, Zoe, always stay true to yourself. And I think that carries through everything I do in music. I feel, you know, we were talking earlier about playing baritone saxophone as a woman in a world that doesn't see bass instruments as something I'm supposed to play. I will take the controversial side, so long as it's ethical, and you know, but something that I truly believe in, I'm gonna stay true to myself. And so I've taken that everywhere I go.
And you're in the process of taking that to a pack of kids in East Windsor, and who knows where that will get them. The moral of the story.
We'll see. We're driving on the road.
I so appreciate you joining me today and getting the ball rolling on this little podcast interview series talking about band culture and doing the good work in the trenches. Connecticut music educator and a whole lot of other things, Zoe Stinson, thanks so much for giving the podcast a piece of your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, one last break and then we'll head for the big finish. Thanks to you, dear listener, for staying with me. Here comes the dogfight. This week's dogfight is another band-related internet rabbit hole of the week. Where I offer up one of my online excursions that you may be inspired to pursue yourself, thereby completely destroying an evening. This week's rabbit hole of the week belongs to the Balkan Paradise Orchestra. It's a small band originally from Barcelona, Spain, which I bet you didn't see coming, given their name, and I didn't either. Their repertoire uses traditional Balkan music as a jumping-off point, but their sound will come from almost anywhere. Almost immediately after they formed in 2015, they won several European musical prizes and competitions. Although they've recorded albums and produced videos, it seems to me that their strength is in their live performance. And there are a bunch of videos online showing them at work on street corners, in subway stations, and at outdoor music festivals. The instrumentation has fluctuated a tiny bit over the years, but the basic idea has been three trumpets, a French horn, a trombone or two, a tuba or two, two percussionists, and a pair of clarinetists, one of whom doubles on bass clarinet. They're all capable of ferocious improvisational solo work, and yeah, that does include the bass clarinetist. Oh yeah, and one other detail, they're all women. The stereotypical gender norms and expectations that have been part of the music world are a topic for another time, and a worthy one, I think. For those of us who grew up in the 20th century, where most flute players were girls and most trumpet and tuba and percussion folks were boys, the BPO is a band that gleefully busts up those stereotypes. I'm pretty sure that I'm not running afoul of copyright or licensing rules if I play you a very short clip taken from an amateur video of the BPO playing a traditional folk tune on a street corner somewhere. For various reasons that I can talk about more some other time, I'm exceptionally aware of the whole permissions question, but I've got a little excerpt which I'll link in the show notes that will sufficiently pique your interest, and here it is. Makes this group really something else. And no, you can't see it on an audio-only podcast, I get that. So let's just say that the current trendy choreography that is taking over the marching arts activity is going to have to up its game if it wants to keep up with the BPO. Take a look at some video. A gateway link is in our show notes, or you can run a YouTube search for Balkan Paradise Orchestra, B-A-L-K-A-N, and I think you'll see what I mean. It's just a pack of fun. And for all my woodwind friends out there, those two clarinet people are never far from the spotlight, even amongst all the wailing brass. Okay, so let's pause one more time to catch our breath, and we'll wrap things up for this week. Thanks for listening this far. To wrap up this week, let's take the coda. For the coda this week, a couple of quick thoughts about the start of this podcast. Namely, necessarily, this second episode was a lot closer to what I think the thing will be like from here on, give or take a tweak. The first episode was, again, very much like a television series pilot episode. In addition to wanting to tell a decent story, the show had to introduce its characters and do a fair amount of exposition. In short, I was telling, not showing. Happily, that won't happen too often from now on. One thing that can't happen very much in the first couple of podcast episodes is a segment featuring letters, we get letters, contributions from our listeners, questions and answers, opinions, band stories, that sort of thing. But now that it's conceivable that Bandwagon might actually have some listeners now, I would like to invite you all not to be shy about being in touch. I really look forward to having the second strain not be my commentaries all the time, but yours as well. And maybe the coda will become letters to the editor. As long as I'm going to talk about building a community with this podcast thing, best that I not hog the mic all the time. This episode's interview went some distance toward making my voice not the only one you'll hear. Trust me, I like it that way too. So, as I say in another of my online communication projects, keep in touch and stay connected. Let's continue to see if we can build something here. That's Bandwagon for this week. Thanks as always for downloading and listening. Bandwagon was written, researched, and produced by your humble host. Musical interludes were produced by Hammerton Media from source material largely by John Philip Sousa. You can listen to more episodes at our website, heyband.podbean.com. Please give me feedback, be polite, but let me know what you like and what you think might change. Tell me your best band story or suggest a topic for a future episode, whatever you like. You can do that using our email address, heybandwagon@yahoo.com, or leave us a 90-second voice message by going to speakpipe.com/heybandwagon. Be aware that we do reserve the right to include your message on the podcast unless you say otherwise. All those contact links and links to our news items, conversation topics, and interview guests can be found in our show notes. Please share the show on social media, and thank you for that. If you enjoyed this podcast, get someone else to listen as well. As it turns out, word of mouth is the best recruiting tool. And to keep up with us every week, subscribe to Bandwagon on the Podbean app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please give us a 5-star review. It really helps other people to find the show. For now, take care, stay in touch, stay in tune, and we'll do this all again next week. I'm Rob Hammerton. Detail, Fallout.